Thank you, Mr. Sabine, for your testimony. And I know we all appreciate, and Secretary Salazar has spoken to me personally about what you just commented on, going through the process and deciding how it can be made more responsive. That is the process of petition and acknowledgement, because it is a process in dire need of an overhaul. In the case of two of the pending bills, the Chinook and the Duwamish petitions, the OFA staff and the former assistant secretary and then the former acting assistant secretary, along with their tribal recognition consultants, came to different conclusions as to whether or not they should be granted federal acknowledgement. Does the fact that two groups, both trained and very well educated, the fact that they came to different conclusions highlight that the interpretation of the regulations is highly subjective?
Well, are you asking whether the interpretation of the regulation is highly subjective?
Yes.
I don't think so. I think that the criteria are, to a certain degree, are overly are very detailed, so that in fact that makes it maybe why it's difficult for some of these groups to satisfy all seven criteria, and all seven S would be satisfied. It's not, you know, six out of seven or whatever. So I am not sure that really they're that highly subjective. There may be room for interpretation, obviously, and that's what happened there. But overall, I think that, we have, I can think of other regulations, like our land into trust regulation, the 25 CFR Part 151, that are a lot more subjective than the regulations in 25 CFR Part 83, for instance. There's a question of interpretation.
Does the assistant secretary or the acting assistant secretary have the authority to overrule a recommendation from the Office of Federal Acknowledgement?
Yes.
On a petition or recognition?
Yes, absolutely. I think that as long as there is a rational basis for overruling or changing the recommendation, then it is the decision of the assistant secretary, and under the regulations, that's what it is. So, for instance, when I receive the recommendation from OFA, the Office of Federal Acknowledgement, on Lilleshall, I will read every line and I will see if I agree with it. And if I do not, then I will go back to the staff and say, these are my issues, you know, and unless they need to be satisfied because I am the final decision maker.
Why doesn't the administration's testimony make any reference to the earlier positive final determination that the Duwamish received on their petition from the Clinton administration?
Well, we don't go into that kind of detail here. The bottom line is that the final decision from Assistant Secretary McCaleb is the decision that is the administration's current position. And I want to add that on the Duwamish petition, the Duwamish tribe has sued the department over this issue. So I'm just going to say that this is the position of the department is that the decision of Mr. McCaleb is our final determination, the one we are defending in court. But I'm not real sure that, nor would I be the expert to go into the details of that determination.
Gentleman from Washington. Gentleman from Michigan. Mr. Kildee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And again, thank you, Mr. Sabine, for testifying before the committee. We all respect you up here, and no one questions your sincerity. I think we do question from time to time if you have seen your conclusion on these things. I have introduced bills through the years, I think my own bills and co-sponsored others, but my own bills were about five tribes. I think one was Lac Vert d'Isere many years ago when I first came to Congress. And Little River, Little Traverse, the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi. And we recognized, not granted, recognized their sovereignty. And again, based that recognition upon the facts of treaties. And nothing negative ever happened after that. I mean, the neighbors of those tribes enjoy the fact that they have a sovereign Indian tribe as their neighbor, doing better now than they were before. And again, I personally respect you, but I just disagree with your conclusions. And of course, you work for others too. You work for the department. But when you list the sovereign tribes in this country, 500 and some sovereign tribes, you don't put, do you, an asterisk next to those that were recognized by Congress?
I mean, no, we do not.
So they're all sovereign, no matter how we arrived at the recognition of their sovereignty.
Absolutely.
So there's no asterisk. So we like to get some other tribes with listed as sovereign, recognizing their sovereignty without the asterisk. And again, I thank you for your work. I know it's a difficult job, and no one questions your sincerity. I yield back.
I'm going to share one of the interesting things that I learned during the last administration at the Department of the Interior. I was on, in the waning years of the last administration, a committee that was put together by the then Secretary of Interior. It was co-chaired by former U.S. Senator Robert Kerry and former U.S. Senator Jake Garn. And we were looking at essentially a performance audit of the Minerals Management Service. Among the things that we discovered during that period of time is that Native Americans had never had their mineral valuation rules changed to conform with non-Indian mineral rights, and even though they had sought for over a decade the opportunity to conform federal mineral royalty mineral valuation rules to non-Indian mineral rules, it had never happened. And the Navajo in particular had written letter after letter after letter and petitioned and pleaded. And it seemed like that their letters, their petitions, their desire, which would have been good for all tribes who have mineral royalties, just got lost. It was like a black hole in the Department of the Interior. It just never happened. And so we finally called that to the attention of the administration at the very highest levels, and that was one productive thing that occurred out of that study. I wonder if in some of these cases there are similar black holes with regard to the recognition of tribes. I'm curious what accountability mechanisms are in place to guarantee the department will follow through on timelines, because I've seen it happen in another venue at Interior.
On timelines, mm-hmm. I think the regulations in 25 CFR Part 83 do contain timelines that need to be followed. But I think that one of the issues is that even with the timelines, the process takes an inordinate long amount of time. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that we will be looking at.
Do you think it might make sense to, once a tribe's criteria have been met for recognition, that a period of time be set under which the department has to make a decision? And if that time lapses, they're automatically recognized. That way, the onus, the burden, is on the department to make a decision rather than on the tribe seeking recognition, having met the criteria, to wait and wait and wait and wait.
Well, I think that under the regulations, once the criteria are, if the Office of Federal Acknowledgement determines that all criteria are met for a positive determination, then the decision, then essentially a decision will be, I don't think it's ever happened that then a decision stays not acted on for an inordinate amount of time. I think that by then, a decision from the assistant secretary is is going to happen very quickly, and there are deadlines to follow for that. I think currently under the regulation, a decision of can be appealed to the Interior Board of Indian Appeals, where it can take then much longer, several years, for the petition to be finally determined. And that, I think, is an issue that I'm going to take a look at.
Good. I'm also interested in how some of these recognition processes fall prey to political pressure, which seems to have been the case with some of the tribes that we're hearing about today. Could you comment on that? Just in general, how does that happen?
I am not really have the expertise historically to comment on that, because I've only been involved in this particular issue of recognitions for about a little bit over a year, mm-hmm. and before that I was not involved at all in that process. So the petition for the Duwamish and the Chinook and Burt Lake, I've not been involved, so I'm not sure that I can comment how it happens. Or I know there's been a lot of cases, and I've read that in the papers also, but I'm not really the competent to answer that question at this point. I'm sorry about that.
That's okay. Thank you so much for your testimony.
General Lady from California, Mr. Palatano.
So many questions that come to mind in regard to the past, and I guess maybe my concern is you say you've been only 1 year on the recognition issues, so you can't really address why there's been such a lag in the BIA. Is it because of the lack of personnel? Is it because of, as was asked by my colleague, the political pressure? Can you give some insight as to what you found when you took it over and what you feel needs to be done to be able to effectively deal with all those issues?
Well, I think that, of course, I'm not, is probably the subject of another hearing. So I'm not representing the views of the secretary here or the assistant secretary, since they will have views on that. But I think that one of the issues that we're going to have to look at is at the regulations themselves, and to see why it takes so long for a petition to from start to finish. And perhaps there are steps that are not necessary to go through. Perhaps the timelines can be tightened up. I think the suggestion that in some cases, if no action is taken and it's deemed, there's a deemed approval or deemed disapproved, that's something that we have in other regulations, and I know in some acts of Congress, for self-determination contracts, we have 90 days to approve, otherwise it's deemed approved, 90 days to decline, otherwise deemed approved. So we'll have to take a look at that. And we can also, to some degree, formalize the process to make it more formal so that there is no outside interference. I know that the OFA staff is definitely not keen on having to deal with outside parties in terms of
political pressure.
So we'll have to take a look at that also.
That leads into the BIA's criteria determination. Do you think that needs tightening up and very much defined? Would that be internal through the secretary, would that require congressional guidance?
We can revise the regulations without congressional guidance. The regulations themselves were promulgated on 25 CFR Part 83, pursuing, I think, to the general authority of the under 25 USC 2 and 9 to promulgate regulations. So we can do that if the administration decides to move forward in that direction.
So it's up to the administration,
yes.
In other words. So right. If any administration comes in and decides that they don't want to take a focus on bettering these issues with the Native Americans, then it's everybody's game changes, if you will. I mean, if there is not will to be able to pursue clarification or
right.
moving these forward.
Well, then the regulations stay as they are.
I know, but they can be interpreted by the administration's new people.
Well, but I think interpretation of those regulations, that goes back to the question of whether they're that subjective, and I'm not sure that they are. So I think that when we get the reports from the Office of Federal Acknowledgement, it's very comprehensive and relies on the facts. So I think of course, if it's not correct, then it can be changed. But it is. I don't think it would be because it is all that subjective.
Well, yeah, but it can be changed only if the tribe appeals to Congress or has the money to hire lobbyists to be able to get it done.
Oh,
what
no,
I'm trying
no.
to get is how do we manage the process? Now, my time's running out, but in 2002, the Duwamish appealed to the Interior Board of Indian Affairs to reinstate the decision for recognition, but they dismissed this appeal for lack of jurisdiction over the interpretation of the administrative action taken by former Acting Assistant Secretary. If not the Interior, then whose jurisdiction does this fall under?
Well, a final decision on the petition can be then appealed to federal district court. And in fact, this is what happened in the Duwamish case, and there's current litigation pending challenging the final determination of the Assistant Secretary.
Oh, Mr. Chair, would you indulge me?
Yes, the gentlelady may proceed.
Thank you, sir. On H.R. 3084 in 1997, under the 78 regulations, 1978, when the Chinook tribe petitioned, one of the criteria was being able to be identified as an Indian entity by outside observers. Who are these outside observers, and how that would determine how reputable a tribe is? Again, this may be a criteria that is maybe connected to the outside observers within that area, elected officials or others, but who are they and how do they have the power to be able to say whether the tribe is reputable or not?
Well, I think that's one of the difficult criteria that we are going to take a look at this point. Outside observers means by someone not connected to the tribe, essentially.
But how is that determined whether that person is able? I mean, if somebody decides that they don't want the tribe to have that recognition, they can appoint somebody who may not be in favor of it. Who determines impartially?
All right. To answer that technical question, I think I would have to call the director of the office who is sitting in the audience here.
Would you please?
Sure, please. Mr. Lee Fleming. And he's right here.
External identifications are from individuals not connected with the petitioning group, but would be like congressmen, senators who write a letter saying we have a group in our jurisdiction, and this could be a letter in 1911, it could be a letter or a document in the 20s. The group needs to demonstrate from 1900 to the present that these external identifications have taken place. It's not a matter of whether the group is reputable. It's simply identifications that the group is identified as an American Indian entity. So if in a newspaper there's an article about the group in a particular county and they cover the event and that group is identified as an American Indian entity, that type of evidence falls within our criteria.
So it's multiple choices, sort of.
Yes, and records are available on various levels.
Another criteria states that a predominant portion of its members comprise a distinct social community at present or since 1950. If the Chinook people have recorded data of their culture, villages, and population since the early 1800s, why would that not be a consideration?
Well,
Well, that was the reason I believe that the Bush administration reversed the previous decision, acknowledging the tribe. I mean, that doesn't make sense.
The regulations require continuous existence. And if there is an evidentiary gap within the record, let's say the group did not have evidence for a community for a 40 or 50 year time span, under the regulations, we are required to point out that deficiency.
But again, requirements are defined so that these people know, or any tribe would know, that they need to do something to continue that recorded recognition of their existence.
Right. We issue technical assistance review letters early on in the process, pointing out any obvious deficiencies or significant omissions. When we issue the proposed finding, we outline any deficiencies at that time in the record for each of the seven criteria, giving the petitioner and interested parties an opportunity to address those deficiencies. If they are cured after the proposed finding and the group meets all seven mandatory criteria, then we move forward with a positive final determination. If they're not cured, then we move forward with a recommendation that the group not be acknowledged as an Indian tribe.
Okay. Well, two questions come out of that. Do you notify tribes that are requesting recognition that they must submit this information, or that they, if they are looking at seeking recognition, that they must record, they must have this evidentiary information?
Yes. We are, under our regulation, we are required to notify the groups of their deficiencies in these technical assistance review letters. It's in 83.10 of the regulation. And then they're notified of those deficiencies.
No, but that's only when you give them those seven requirements. But do you, as a norm, since you have all these Indian tribes that you know are either seeking or are in the process of seeking, do you send them information? Do you remind them that they have to seek this information to support their case to the BIA?
We do, through the technical assistance review letters.
Okay.
And the groups also from time to time request technical assistance.
Okay, and then the last question, of course, is what can we do to prevent this back and forth process that seems to be detrimental in Congress? What can Congress do?
I'm not sure if I understand what you mean by back and forth.
Well, the criteria is not met. The tribes have been waiting for 40, 50 years. That's a pretty good expanse of time. Have there been tribes that have had a shorter span of time of non-ability to present this information to say that they have been, recorded data of their culture of some kind, newspaper, letters, whatever?
Right. The evidentiary gap that, based on our precedent, anything greater than 10 to 12 years is considered a gap. If there's a 50-year gap or a 70-year gap, that is a major evidentiary deficiency.
Okay, so you do have a time span you look at.
Based on precedent, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've been
very
great. Yes, I will. I ran out of time, but please.
The church records would be one of the sources of evidentiary material, would it not?
Yes.
Church records. And in the case of Burt Lake, the Catholic Church keeps tremendous records. I mean, my baptismal record, as the date I was baptized, the day I did my confirmation, the day I was married. I got married in Timbuktu. That Catholic Church in Timbuktu is obligated to notify the church in Flint, Michigan that I got married, so I couldn't pull a second marriage somehow. But the Catholic Church we have records going back to Genghis Khan. By the way, he was not baptized, but... it's a great source of evidentiary material, and the Catholic Church there around Burt Lake has sent you material based upon a vast array of evidence which they keep for ecclesiastical reasons. It would seem that that should play a role, and how much a role has that played in your decision on the Burtlick Band?
We review the evidence that is presented by each petitioning group. And in the review of the evidence, and albeit church records are wonderful because they do document birth, marriage, and death, and locations are given. But in the review of the evidence, if there are any evidentiary gaps, then we have to point those out, and we would hope that the petitioner would be able to cure those gaps. If they cure the deficiency, again, they're acknowledged. If they do not cure the deficiency, they are not acknowledged.
The church felt strong enough, looking at the evidence they had in their records, to give the Burtlick Band land. The church felt this was a question of justice. The land had been taken from them, but based upon their own continuous evidence from great-great-grandfather to grandfather to father, to son and daughter, they felt that they had some responsibility of giving them some land in light of the fact that the evidence proved that they certainly had been there and certainly stood there around the turn of the century watching their village burn at the order of the sheriff. I think that's strong evidence myself, and I would hope you would keep looking at that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ranking member, wish to have ask questions? Jason? Gentleman from Virginia, no question? Gentleman from Washington, Mr. Inslee.
Thank you. Mr. Scavino, I'm trying to figure out the department's position on this, and the best thing I can do is give a hypothetical. I have an ancestor who was Chief Five Crows of the Cayuse in southeastern Washington. That tribe was subsumed by the Umatillas. Essentially now their ancestors predominantly live in Umatilla in northeastern Oregon. Let's assume that the Cayuse sought recognition and went through the department's process. The department designated decision maker essentially signed off on the recognition, made an administrative error, failed to sign one or two copies he was supposed to. The administration then turned the federal government over to another administration. In those circumstances, what would the department's position be about recognition? Would it and should it give some weight or honor of the previous decision of the department?
Well, I'm sure that the previous position of the department would be considered, but I think it's customary for new administration to come in, and that's happened this time and certainly happened in 2001, to essentially scrutinize the 11th-hour decisions of the previous administration. And so when the new administration comes in, let's say there's a decision made in January of, for this year it would be January 2009, I think the new administration is taking a close look at some of these decisions as we speak right now. And if it decides that it doesn't agree with them, it will pull them back and essentially revisit them. So I think the administrations have the authority to do that. But as it happens, I think it will take a very hard look at the reasons underlying the decision to see if they can be supported. So it's a matter of taking a very close look at those issues. There's going to be difference, obviously, because the decision was made. But it certainly can be revisited and overturned.
I want to make sure I understand your answer. It would not be revisited or reviewed if, in fact, in this case, in the Duwamish case, the final paperwork, the extra two copies had been signed. You would not, the agency would not have revisited it in that case, would they have?
No, it could have. It could have, because right now, give you another example, not within the recognition issue, but an issue that I was involved at the time, and that was setting forth a scope of gaming, for Indian gaming, for the Seminole Tribe of Florida, we issued a decision in January 19th of 2001, a decision that we took over a year to make, and it was a very difficult decision. And the new administration came in; they essentially withdrew it.
Do you mean to say that if the agency recognized a tribe, say in 1998, that in 2009 the agency, you believe, reserves the right to go back and withdraw that recognition?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that if a new administration comes in, I think that the view has been that decision made in the dying days of the previous administration, especially if there is a change between Democrat and Republican, are revisited. And I think both Republicans and Democratic administrations have taken the position that it is a legitimate function of the new administration to explore and look at decisions made in those.
But I want to mention, do you take the position that if one administration fully recognizes a tribe pursuant to this process, crosses the T's and dots all the I's to do that, that the next administration can withdraw that recognition?
I think re-examine it if the decision is a decision made at the very end of the administration.
I think that's kind of a surprising position to take, and troublesome one to think, if you've got this process, even if you follow it, that then Uncle Sam can come and just pull the rug out from underneath the tribe. I have to tell you, that's very troublesome that you would take that position. Now, in this case, that may not be totally the case because there was a clerical error. Nonetheless, I have to tell you that that position is troublesome to me. Could you tell me, I have the Point Elliott Treaty in front of me, and it shows the very first tribe mentioned is the Duwamish, and the very first signatory is Seattle, chief of the Duwamish and Suquamish tribes. What role does that treaty play in recognizing or not recognizing the Duwamish? Here we have a tribe that was recognized in the treaty, signed as an entity by its recognized chief, Seattle. What role, in your view, does that play in the recognition issue?
I'm going to have to ask Mr. Fleming to answer that question because I was not involved in that decision.
Excuse me. I may have missed it, but just so the record is clear, could you identify your full name and position, please? You may have already, and I apologize if you're repeating it.
My name is Lee Fleming, and I'm the director of the Office of Federal Acknowledgement. Thank you.
This treaty was signed in my district, too, so I have some territorial interest.
Many groups make claims that they are associated with a treaty or several treaties, and these claims are reviewed under 83.8 of our regulation. It's called unambiguous previous federal acknowledgement. If a group has this claim of a treaty, then the issue is, does the current group descend from that treaty-making tribe? And so then it becomes a genealogical type of review as well as historical to see if the current group does go back to that particular treaty. So when you do have a treaty that has names of the leaders listed, that helps in that review of understanding that the current group descends back to that treaty. Additionally, if the claim appears to connect the treaty tribe with the current group, then the petitioner has an evidentiary break. It means that they would only need to demonstrate from that last point of unambiguous previous acknowledgement of that treaty. In this case, it was a treaty of 1855, so the group didn't have to go back to earlier times to demonstrate descent from an historical Indian tribe.
So as I understand this treaty, and I've just reviewed it today, the treaty established in this case some designated lands that the signatories were agreed to be removed to, if you will, one of which is in the west side of Puget Sound, where the Suquamish hold out. And there doesn't appear to be land in the what I would think of as the Duwamish geographic area now over in the east side of Puget Sound. What role does that, if any, should it play in a recognition issue?
Well, this is what we do in our office. We need to understand how the group is traveling through time. And if a particular portion or a group heads to a particular location on a reservation or such, then we need to follow that group as it existed at that location. And again, does the current group then descend from that particular group that settled on that reservation, or did another portion go to a different location and such? So we have to analyze whether the current group had traveled through time together as a distinct social and political entity. And we'll, in some cases, we find that they do match, and some cases individuals are members of other federally recognized tribes, or they are members of other petitioning groups.
Anyway, it doesn't sound dispositive, is what you're telling me. In other words, the fact that the treaty did not establish a designated geographical entity for the Duwamish should not preclude their recognition now. That's correct, isn't it?
Well, I'm hesitant to answer your question because we are in litigation with Duwamish, but I invite you to read our decision-making documents, which are available on our internet site, which outlines and discusses the evidence as it falls under each of those seven mandatory criteria.
Thank you.
Gentleman from Washington, Mr. Baird.
I'd like to follow up on my colleague from Washington's line of questioning, Mr. Inslee, in the case, and perhaps our witnesses can talk about this. Not only is there examples where a tribe was recognized and then a subsequent administration withdrew the recognition, that's the case of our friends in the Chinook. I was at the recognition ceremony when it happened. But my understanding is, and this is the question I have for these gentlemen, is it seems to be a one-way door. In other words, there seems to be a presumption that a recognition that has been granted can be withdrawn by a subsequent administration. But a recognition that is withdrawn or rejected, rather, could not be re-granted. Help me understand the precedent or logic of that.
No, in my view, any decision, whether it is one to acknowledge or a decision to decline to acknowledge, would be reviewable by the new administration.
Uh-huh.
So it's not just... It is not just something that takes away an acknowledgement decision. The opposite decision would also, the new administration would come in.
Let me follow up and
do that.
Let me follow up on that, though. It's the nature of presidential terms that they tend to run 4 to 8 years, and there seems to be, back to Mr. Inslee's line of questioning, well, there seems to be some kind of time limit by which things can be reviewed. Why is a what may be perhaps interpreted as a precipitous decision, although I don't see it precipitous if it succeeded a long, long line of evidence and review, et cetera, and just happens to have come at the end of an administration. Why is that any more in question, in other words, an outgoing administration's decision, any more in question than a brand new administration's decision?
I really cannot answer that question.
You see what I mean? I
know what you mean, but in my career, I've seen it happen every time there is a change.
No, I've seen it in my career as well, but I've only seen it unidirectionally. And I just would question the logic of that. The only other thing I would just... it seems to be one-directional, and there's by nature the new administration may be even more questionable in its withdrawal than was the prior administration in its approval, given that the prior administration had 8 years to look at it and the new administration probably had 8 weeks.
I agree with that, yeah.
The issue I raised earlier in my remarks about justice, there always seems to be a paradox here to me that the government of the United States and the local or regional governments, in some cases acted with injustice, in my judgment, and created the conditions through that injustice that thereby disqualify their descendants many years later from seeking justice. In other words, we say, we're not going to recognize you, and because we don't recognize, even though you exist, you have a government, everybody knows it, first guys who came here knew it, but we've decided because you wouldn't take our terrible deal of leaving your land and going somewhere where you don't want to go and probably aren't welcome anyway, because you don't take that deal, we're not going to recognize you. We're not going to talk to you. We're not. In fact, in the case of the Chinook, there are plenty of examples where they, in fact, did maintain contact. But just for the sake of this argument, let's suppose they say that. But you still exist. You still have a government. You haven't left where you were. For principle, you haven't left. But then 200 or 100 years later, we say, oh, you know, we don't have the kind of evidence we want that our government dealt with that government because our government decided not to deal with them. But that is somehow dispositive to prove that they didn't exist? It seems to me that the guys who perpetrated the injustice are getting to define the terms of later justice.
I think that's a very valid point. And that's why we acknowledge, in my testimony, we say that Congress may have some very good reasons to recognize legislatively some of these groups who have failed our test.
That's certainly why I'm here today. Thank the chairman.
Any further questions? Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, for being with us today and for your expert testimony. The chair will note that we have a series of five votes underway on the floor of the House. And so before introducing the next panel, I'm going to recess the committee till 1 o'clock, we'll say. That should allow plenty of time for voting on the floor. And I know many of the witnesses have been patient during the course of the morning, allow you to step out and take a break before we start the final panel three of the day. The committee stands in recess.